I think for this discussion in particular, uncertainty is the word you might hear me say 50 times in the next 25 minutes. Very few things are certain. Taxes, me getting older, gravity, you know, there's some of those things that are certain. But when we get into the marketplace, right, and what's impacting the profitability of, doesn't matter if I have a sow farm, finishing farm, doesn't matter if it's Iowa, doesn't matter if it's Brazil, by the way, I think there's lots of things that are highly uncertain at the moment. Macroeconomic uncertainty, so how strong global activity is in different countries, what the exchange rates are, what the trade access terms and duration and persistence are, what the disease situation is, you know, access to packing capacity. One of my personal favorites we can talk about is the strength of consumer demand. So I spend a lot of time on pork demand. There's a long list of things, and you know, I could probably talk for 45 minutes on each one of those.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Keep your feed safe from pathogens with VVC Premix. VVC Premix from DSM Firmenich is made up of ultra-pure benzoic acid and nature-identical flavorings to guard your feed and improve performance. Adiseo provides programs and services to help producers achieve their targets in high-quality, safe, and sustainable way. Better production performance starts with Eastman Choline Chloride. Visit eastman.com. Healthier pigs are good for producers, people, profits, and planet.
Hi there, and welcome to another episode of the Smite It podcast. I'm Dr. Tara Donovan, your host, and today I have Dr. Glenn Tonser from Kansas State University. He's a professor of agricultural economics, and we're going to talk about economics in the swine industry today. So welcome to our podcast, Glenn.
Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. So Glenn's a returning guest on our show, but in case you didn't tune into that episode, I'm going to have him give us a little bit more of an introduction of himself so we get to know him better. Go ahead.
Yeah, as you noted, Glenn Tonser, I'm a professor in the Department of Agriculture Economics here at Kansas State University. I've been here in a related role since 2010. Before that, I was at Michigan State for 4 years. And before that, I was actually here as a graduate student. But for your listeners, if you haven't seen me, you know, kind of with cleaner hands now holding the microphone, my experience before that goes back to the farm. So I actually grew up on a fair to finish hog farm in Missouri. And I interject that because we're on Swine It podcast. Oftentimes, you know, when people comment on my comments, I'm attempting to be real world relevant, but then a geeky economist to help, right? Bring something new to the discussion. And I hope what your listeners get from that is some grounded insight from my days when, you know, my fingernails weren't quite as clean, when I was pressure washing a hog barn and the like. And fast forward with sort of too many times, too many years, looking at textbooks and studying the markets and so forth, and now engaging with a microphone instead of a power washer. But there's value in both, right? I mean, I'm not saying one job is better than the other, but I'm giving you a background context on me because I try to be grounded and relevant, but then bring the geeky econ stuff that I'm kind of trained to do and asked to bring to the table. And I hope your listeners get that out of our time here today as well, Tara.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, growing up in the industry gives you a good perspective of, you know, change over time and also what we're facing, not only on the barn level, but also, you know, on the profitability level.
And I'll add quickly to that, you know, I'm a little younger than I might look. 1998 was my senior year of high school. And I'm bringing that up not because young or old matters in this discussion, but in terms of shaping somebody, 1998 in the hog industry was very relevant. When you were operating in northern Missouri and you couldn't give a hog away in Iowa at the end of December of 98, you know, I remember that, you know, quite cleanly, as do some of our more experienced members here. And, you know, I empathize with those situations, I guess, is the point. That's why I interject that for background as well.
Yeah, absolutely. That was my graduating year of veterinary school. And so getting a job in the swine industry was fairly dismal at that time. But we persevered and it's been a successful career. So yeah, good point.
A worldwide leader in animal nutrition, Adiseo's portfolio of products includes nephironine, the full range of vitamins, enzymes, organic selenium, probiotics, mycotoxin management strategies, and palatability products. With such a diverse offering, Adiseo supports its customers with a broad range of expertise, tools, and services to help them maintain a competitive advantage. Adiseo, fueling predictable profits. To learn more, visit Adiseo at www.adiseo.com.
So today we're learning about the economics of the swine industry. Start us off with just your view of the most significant economic shifts in the global industry that we're facing right now. So we'll start broad.
Yeah. So, and I would have taken us broad even if you didn't ask, because I think for this discussion in particular, uncertainty is the word you might hear me say 50 times in the next 25 minutes. Very few things are certain. Taxes, me getting older, gravity, you know, there's some of those things that are certain. But when we get into the marketplace, right, and what's impacting the profitability of, doesn't matter if I have a sow farm, finishing farm, doesn't matter if it's Iowa, doesn't matter if it's Brazil, by the way, I think there's lots of things that are highly uncertain at the moment. Macroeconomic uncertainty, so how strong global activity is in different countries, what the exchange rates are, what the trade access terms and duration and persistence are, what the disease situation is, you know, access to packing capacity. One of my personal favorites we talk about is the strength of consumer demand. So I spend a lot of time on pork demand. There's a long list of things, and, you know, I could probably talk for 45 minutes on each one of those. We're not going to do that today, but every one of those points is highly uncertain. Sometimes things move in your favor, right? And actually the developments can be positive for your margins. Sometimes they don't. Risk is two-sided. So I'm going to give us that comment as well. But uncertain environment, and I would argue just as uncertain as it was kind of in the heart of the pandemic, but maybe for different reasons. You know, in the heart of the pandemic, we were very focused on the human health part, running plants. Can we physically keep the supply moving? And lots of good effort was made there. And, you know, in many ways, the industry was more resilient than we thought. Kudos for that. We shouldn't forget those lessons. But there's sort of a new set of challenges that present some very similar uncertainties on market forces today.
Great. So I'm sure you haven't been asked this recently, but what about the trade disputes? How is that going to influence the pork prices and producer profitability in your mind, right? Because there's nothing certain, as you said.
Yeah, you're right. I haven't been asked today about that yet. But you can't go a work week, and it's pretty hard to go 2 days without that coming up. I want to encourage people to think about the summation sign in math. Now, I'm going to get geeky to make a concept point. So the summation sign is, you know, sum up 2, 3, 4 terms to get the sum, right? The addition. A lot of people approach international trade as a zero sum concept is, you know, the U.S. and country A, and I'm purposely going to be vague here for a moment to not get political. You know, we trade with somebody else and we've got to be equal in offsetting trade. That's a zero sum kind of mentality. I discourage that as an economist that believes that trade raises the economic profile, the opportunities for industries and people on both sides of that. I'm going to respond to your question exactly that way, because one of the core uncertainties at the moment is what is tomorrow and next month and the next 20 years of international pork trade look like. The U.S. is not alone, right, as a major global pork producer. There's others around the world. There are comparative advantages the U.S. holds we can talk about, but there's other competing, you know, sources around the world. And we're in the midst of some broader international trade, and then go narrower international ag, and then go narrower international pork, right, trade developments. I remain quite concerned that as the U.S. ag sector, I'm purposely getting broader pork for a moment, becomes less present or less favorable on the international trade front, that that harms our domestic industries. And I hold that concern for pork as well. So to put a bow on this, I encourage our listeners to not have a zero sum kind of mindset to trade. I actually think comparative advantage and, you know, me and you swapping efforts and we're both better does hold. It's not just a geeky textbook concept. You know, over time, it's been proven to hold. The U.S. has a lot of global strengths in producing pork. But to leverage that, we need to have access and we need to seek access and we need to sustain access in global markets. And that's never been a small feat, but I think the challenges in doing that are quite elevated here in 2025.
Yeah. So in a market that's so dynamic, as you mentioned, what indicators would producers and stakeholders watch to anticipate this change?
Yeah. So I mentioned earlier, I'd work a lot on pork demand. So end user, right? Somebody that buys a pork item. So it doesn't matter if it's bacon, loin, whatever. And there's a lot of mixed, I don't mean conflicting signals, but a lot of different data sources and metrics you can watch that you sort of got to culminate them all together to tell the story. And I'll just name drop some of those references here. is a meat demand monitor is something that's based here at Kansas State, funded by the pork checkoff and the beef checkoff. And it is a deep dive into domestic issues. So lots of things about domestic retail, domestic food service, separately for pork loin versus bacon. You know, we could geek out about that, but that's a fairly new resource, started in 2020. There's USDA reported information on the domestic market. There's USDA Foreign Ag Service information on the export market. USMEF, so United States Meat Export Federation, their job is to promote beef, pork, and lamb abroad, you know, get U.S. products into other countries. They regularly have reports, and the pork parts of those would be relevant. But I just rattled off a whole bunch of them. The net of those shows up at the wholesale level. So our producers here, particularly U.S. producers, are probably a little more familiar with the pork cutout. So USDA reports the comprehensive pork cutout, and that's a culmination of the estimated value of the animal. So a barrel and gilt when it's harvested, you know, it's kind of a summation of the value of the loin products, the belly products, and so forth. What I want to impress on your listeners is that price that's reported by USDA, USDA's best effort to value the carcass that day, is the net of all the forces I just talked about. So foreign demand, domestic demand, split between restaurant and, you know, grocery store and so forth, the net of all that shows up at the wholesale level. So if you want one number to watch, it's the value of the wholesale. Now, that alone doesn't tell me which part of that end user demand is getting weaker or stronger, because it's the net of that. But from your farm and, like, on the, you know, live animal side of this thing, you sort of don't care which reason. Geeks like me care, and we tell the story about where the weaknesses and strengths are. But for on-farm relative, you know, profitability, understanding what the cutout is and kind of why it is or isn't going up is where I would encourage people to focus their attention.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I appreciate that. It's a good summation of what we should be looking at. You know, it's hard to think about how a producer can impact that, right? So let's dig in a little bit into, you know, something a little bit more tangible, right?
You know, I give 10-minute segments of talks that, you know, don't stress over the things you can influence, but you're foolish not to be aware of them. Now, there's a balance there, right? So, you know, if you can do things to nudge your cost of production to be 2% lower, focus your effort there because you have some influence. But in today's world, it's foolish not to be aware of these broader things, right? So, you know, as a kind of a aside here, we're doing this recording in advance of the Jackson Hole Federal Reserve meeting that's going to occur, that's going to be the latest update on whether interest rates are going to go down or not. Well, obviously me, you, and nobody listening to this podcast are going to sway what happens or says in Jackson Hole. But if the interest rates go down by a quarter or don't go down by a quarter versus what you expected, it matters. Your borrowing cost, and you and your lender are going to have a different discussion and so forth. So don't stress about it because you can't influence it, but you darn sure need to be aware of it.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's go back a little bit to something that does influence, you know, the bottom line of the producer. So tell us about how disease outbreaks or other global events can influence the pork prices and producer profitability in the U.S.
Yeah, so you have a micro or kind of on-farm effect, and then this macro kind of broader effect. The micro or the personalized, obviously, if the disease event is on your operation, it's in your face, you see it. If you wanted to sell 100 barrows and you can't sell 100 barrows, we all understand that has a direct effect, right? So it's immediate, it's personal. And I want to, you know, also recognize that's sort of where the mental health aspects of this come from. That's not my area of expertise, but it's well documented that, you know, some in the ag community have, you know, some needs there. I encourage, if you find yourself in that space, I encourage you to reach out and find help. There are, you know, governmental resources and private resources for that. But I'm starting there, Tara, because if it's in your face, like your operation has the disease challenges, it's not just the market realities, it's the psychological, physical, how do I deal with the death and so forth, right? So I want to acknowledge that. Remember my personal on the farm background comments, sort of where that comes from. Now, bigger picture, kind of the macro effect. A lot of folks jump over this one, but I would argue the biggest effect is the potential risk of losing exports. So if you have a disease event in the U.S., it's not uncommon that some of our foreign partners, people that buy ag products, in this case, pork products, at least temporarily stop importing. They very often will stop importing until we clarify the, you know, the regional reach, the duration of it, get some terms, you know, around that. Sometimes that leads to regionalization that's occurred in other commodities and so forth. But what I want to impress on folks from kind of a broader market perspective, usually the biggest trigger for an adverse market response is the lack of international trade. So if all of a sudden we can't send pork loin to somewhere in Asia that we were going to send it, and that has to stay in the U.S., or we can't send ham to Mexico that we're going to, and now it has to stay in the U.S., whatever example it is, you now all of a sudden have more pounds in the U.S. than you expected. The only way you clear that domestic market is to lower the prices more than you would have otherwise, and that puts downward pressure, right, on livestock prices. That situation gets even worse if it's a zoonotic disease or feared to be a zoonotic disease. So if there's a fear to be a human, you know, component, but whether it's disease or contamination and a concern about consuming, quickly we get into social media confusion realm real fast. And if you have a demand pushback that's not just foreign access, but like average Joe consumer now is concerned about eating whatever item, then what I just told you gets even worse, because now the demand for those products is even lower. Downward pressure on livestock prices happens even quicker and stronger. So that's the sequence of things. Now, the exact magnitude is always a function of what disease, where did it happen? Did it hit a large production area or not? What was the terms of trade before that? I mean, every single one of these events is unique. So you'll never get somebody like me to give you a number in answering those questions. But the micro versus macro part of that, I hope makes sense to our listeners. And it's why the industry spends so much time, energy, and money trying to mitigate disease issues.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned regionalization in your comments. So let's go into pork production and what are regional differences in pork production in the U.S. That kind of shape the market, at least in our U.S. market?
Yeah, just, you know, timestamp that for a moment. You know, I played my hand earlier, 1998, I left the farm, right? And the reason I'm reminding us of that is 27 years ago is that comment. You know, the breeding stock in our country is much more geographically dispersed now than it was then. So, you know, again, I'm from northern, you know, Missouri. You can kind of do a belt, northern Missouri through Iowa, southern Minnesota is still the densest part of U.S. pork production. That comment has not changed. But there's a lot more sows west and a lot more east as a percentage of our herd than there was then. So from the breeding herd part of this discussion, so breaking apart the industry for a moment, you know, where the sows and the weaned pig, at least production part of this is, there's actually a geographic hedge in our system compared to before. So space is your friend when it comes to disease, right? It may not be your friend when it comes to transportation costs and other things. Economists say there's always trade-offs. But when it comes to disease management, separating those sows, getting the farms apart, so to speak, has some benefits. And I think the industry has been wise to do that. I'll interject. You also get a little bit of a hedge on labor markets and other things when you do that. So we're talking disease, but, you know, the labor market in Oklahoma and North Carolina is probably not the same because the competing industries, you know, the presence of oil in one versus the other. I mean, lots of other things to think about. There's some other benefits the industry's had that may or may not have been the reason initially. I mean, I think there was a pure disease motivation, you know, early on to repurpose where those buildings went. But I think it's been fortuitous on the breeding side of diseases. Now, when you get to the finishing industry, right, and it's a different set of diseases, we all know when you're talking about a 250-pound barrel and gilt versus the sows, we start to get more Midwest-centric, right? So you go where the corn is and where the manure has value, and it's not quite as geographically dispersed. And that's why some of those diseases are more Midwest-centric versus throughout.
Yeah, absolutely. Putting the, you know, sow farms or clean herds on the fringes, right, of the you know, central Midwest, we've certainly seen a difference in the ability of those farms to stay negative for PRRS and other diseases that, you know, are knocking at our door. So tell us what strategies producers can adopt to remain resilient and profitable. What do you see working out there, and what do you suggest they focus on in terms of you know, strategies, either big or small?
Yeah, so a brief one just to put a bow on our last disease discussion. So I'm an economist, not an epidemiologist, not your local veterinarian, but on that specific discussion, actively having discussions, right? What's our situation? What's kind of knocking on the doorstep, so forth, being informed. I certainly recommend that. I can help connect people with those folks, but that's not my area of expertise. More kind of in my wheelhouse, I usually make this comment half joking because people remember it, is buy your ag lender a cup of coffee. Now, I hope the lender buys you the coffee. In a business relationship, that's usually the way that goes. But the reason I'm interjecting is people might remember that kind of half joke comment is I actually think regular check-ins with your financial partner, right? The lender, and maybe it's other entities that have investments with you. Generalizes common a little bit. Quarterly is the frequency that comes to my mind. You know, probably don't have to be daily, but it shouldn't be every other year, something in between. So quarterly is a good suggestion. If you build the habit and expectation that we're going to cross-check, what do the books look like? What do we think things look like for the next year, 5 years, so forth? And we're doing that all the time. Those discussions are a lot easier when things get tough if we've already been having them. If instead you're not proactive in that and you sort of only pick up the phone when the wheels are falling off the truck, so to speak, now the nature of that discussion is a lot harder. So I think I genuinely believe there's value in proactive and regularly communicating with all partners, right? I started with the disease experts, now went to the financial experts. You know, whoever you do your hedging with, you get in the weeds about whether to hedge the corn you're buying and so forth. You know, you don't talk to them every 60 days. You probably talk to them every other day, right? So there's ongoing communication would be my theme to give people. Not pick a different breed, not, you know, change the pay scale for your workers. I mean, we can get in the weeds on all those kind of things if you like. But honestly, the work on proactive and regular communication is the best suggestion I could give you on just like a business approach. And I think it'll serve you well.
Yeah, good advice. So today we've been discussing the economics of the swine industry with Dr. Glenn Tonser, an agricultural economics professor at Kansas State University. Dr. Tonser, do you have some final thoughts or take homes for our listeners on today's discussion?
Yeah, so I made the comment about uncertainty. You know, I think it's here to stay in lots of ways. There is opportunity in that, and there's probably going to be elevated stress with that. So please make use of your partners and communicate widely. I think most of us are well aware that the public can ask for things they don't pay for, right? So there's examples where they want change and they're not clearly willing to pay more for that pork item. You know, in many ways in the developed world, so the US, Canada, other industries, that's now sort of a cost of doing business. It's not fun to talk about, but I give full talks about that, right? So sort of get used to that frustration is the comment. That isn't fun, but I'm trying to be like direct saying, I don't think it's gonna go away. So it's now a cost of doing business in our society. I'm thrilled we live in a world where we can choose for the most part what we work in and how we produce and so forth. But there's going to be at times some mixed pushback on that is what I'm trying to say. And I think that's the new normal. I think that's definitely the case more than when I left the farm 25 years ago. And my broken crystal ball looking forward is it's not going to go away during the next 25. So stay informed, be aware of those things. But ultimately, there's not much any one producer could do to change it, much like my comment about interest rates earlier. So try to mitigate the personal stress around it, right? You know, ultimately focus on the things you can have some sway on. And most of our listeners have a lot higher opportunity to influence their own cost of production than they do the price they receive. So if you run a sow farm, it's probably a lot more likely you can decrease the cost of producing weaned pigs than it is you can increase the price you get for a weaned pig. I'm all for somebody trying to improve the trade, right? The value, what they get, the revenue side. But honestly, a lot of research has said is the low hanging fruit is to improve your cost of production number. So I usually encourage people to go that direction. And sometimes that surprises them because I'm a guy that gives a lot of market outlook kind of talks that talks about the output price. And that's where questions come from. And that's relevant. We can talk about it. But honestly, back to the things you can influence, they tend to get in the cost of production realm. And the more you can do to focus there, and the more you communicate with your partners to be efficient in making those reductions, I think the more likely you're going to find yourself being economically viable.
It's time for our famous three. We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Fortiva, creating ingredients for impact to support animal resilience and health. Learn more at FortivaImpact.com. Vaxinova, formulate to your needs, custom-made vaccines. SUNY, we provide value-added biotech solutions. Uniferon 200 from Pharmacosmos, the iron dextrin for baby pigs, which promotes faster growth. AB Vista, intelligent nutritional solutions to boost pig health and performance. Swine feed can be contaminated with viral pathogens. From ASF, PED, PERS, and SVA, these pathogens can negatively impact health and performance. Now you can improve feed biosecurity with VVC Premix from DSM Firmenich. VVC Premix is an ultra-pure benzoic acid and can reduce pathogen concentration of feed and also improve gut functionality, weight gain, and feed efficiency. Safeguard your feed with VVC Premix.
Learn more at dsm-firmenich.com/vvc-premix.
So we're rounding out our time together today. I want to say thank you to our listeners. If you have questions or comments, send those to us on your podcast platform. Also, if you liked our show, give us a thumbs up or a like. So the trademark of our show is to ask our guest a few thought-provoking questions at the end to get to know them just a little bit better. So Glenn, what is a book or resource that you is your go-to in your area of expertise?
Grow the Pie is not an agriculture economics book, but conceptually it aligns with my comments earlier about trade. And for probably 3 years, I've included a picture of this book on lots of my talks. And Grow the Pie, the author's name is Edmonds. You can Amazon, Google, these kind of things. Conceptually, it thinks about how do we work with partners to grow the size of our collective business. Same thing holds on, you know, me and another hog producer working together and so forth. I encourage folks that resonate or want more on that concept to go find that book. Another one that is also not Ag Econ, but in the spirit of open and regular communication, is a book called Necessary Endings, and author is Cloud. There's some coaching there about how to assess comparative advantages, relationships, and honestly, at times when you need to end a relationship. That's not fun to talk about, but if you've got a business partner where things aren't right, you've kind of went through the three steps to try to make it better, sometimes it is in your interest and maybe in their interest to, you know, put an end to that. Those are not fun things to talk about, but in the real world, they come up. And that book called Necessary Endings, I think, coaches us through that. On a personal note, I find myself having a hard time to say no, right? It's, you know, it's very easy to say yes, you know, podcasts, you know, there's more of them and so forth, right? We have lots of examples. This is my job, so it's okay for me to do this. Don't overreact to that comment. But I think we all could get better about evaluating the value of our time, how we allocate it. And if we said no to the right stuff, would we be delivering deeper insights on the things we say yes to versus being kind of an inch thick in everything? And I think that holds for me. I think it holds for you, Tara. I think it holds for every producer that's listening, is every human, frankly, to go further with that. We could all get a little bit better about the yes-no decisions we make. And that Necessary Endings book I referenced has kind of helped me think about that. I have a long ways to go to get better about it, but I do think I'm better than, say, 5 years ago. And if it helps us allocate our time better, I honestly think we are more effective in like making the world better in our own way. And I encourage people to pull up that book if that comment resonates with them.
Yeah, absolutely. Great advice. That is a tough thing to do. And especially in an area where we're very much a networked community, right? And so there's somewhat a, you know, dependent upon each other, but you can get really strung out and then that gets more stressful.
Well, and what I call soft no, like in our network discussions, is I can still help somebody by redirecting them to an appropriate resource. So I didn't just say, you know, hell no, I don't have time for you, right? That's a hard no. Sometimes that might be appropriate, but in most cases it's not. Rather, it would be, yes, I got 3 minutes to get you with the right person, as opposed to me taking an hour or a work week or whatever it might be to sort of be half the right person. I'm not helping you if it's not the right person. I'm definitely not helping myself if it's not the right. So sort of those soft no's is what that book coaches us towards. And again, I think the same thing happens on the farm. If you're trying to think through, you know, how do I adjust workforce, right? How do I manage and give somebody the soft no to get them in the right spot in my employee base? There's some value in that that's sort of on the farm shovel ready also.
Yeah. Yeah. Be a connector to kind of shift that. So what about a book or resource not related to the swine industry? And you actually gave us a few of those already. So maybe something else that, you know, we should check out.
Yeah. So the two I gave you actually weren't, I was just trying to give you the ag parts of that. The third one I'll give you just to kind of keep dumping stuff for people, you know, maybe advance their Christmas list, the reading list for the holidays, is Average is Over, is a book that was written by Tyler Cohen. So Cohen is an economist. That particular book's well over 10. It might be 15 years old. I mean, there's slightly updated versions that are out there. But if you want to back up and think through things in our society, right, a lot of geeks like me bring average or representative statistics to you because that's what we get from USDA and so forth. But this entire book is talking about how average is actually very misleading. You know, most things in our world, you've got two or three kind of groups, not like the middle doesn't exist, so to speak. In the world of AI and what AI, not artificial insemination, but artificial intelligence here, might be doing to our economy, that's very relevant to think through what those things might do to disruption to jobs and so forth. And there's clear implications for the workforce and who may or may not be around to work on your hog farms or pork plants and so forth. So average is over is a good reminder about the average statistic can be misleading is the geeky comment here. But the broader point would be, as we have groups in societies that kind of move this way, the average statistic doesn't represent either one of them very well at all. And I think that applies within the hog industry. We've got some hyper efficient, very low cost producers sort of going this way on their cost curve. And we get others that aren't keeping up, that are falling behind over time. And if I give you an average cost of production number, I'm not representing either one, right? So there's a lot of parallels to that. I think holds in every industry I know anything about. And I encourage our listeners to add that to their holiday reading list.
Yeah, absolutely. I have heard about that book before. So it has been around just a bit, but I think still very, very representative of something we should be thinking about. So our last question, Glenn, is share with us an attribute or characteristic that you feel sets successful professionals apart from others.
So I'm going to give you two is intentional communication. I am not perfect about it. I know I speak faster than average. So I'm well aware of an area I can work on. But I made the comment earlier about, you know, active and ongoing regular communication. I think that suggestion holds for every person. Doesn't matter if I'm coaching my three teenagers at home or if I'm talking to CEOs, there's still value in that point. The second one would be I'm a firm believer in identifying accurately your comparative advantage and then leveraging it. And back to my earlier comments, just like on the farm, you know, implications of this, cost of production. So if I learn my bread and butter is I'm better at breeding than the average, double down on it, and breeding success is going to be your secret to lowering the cost of production on the sow farm, right? Maybe when you run a finishing facility, you have less labor turnover than the average person. So therefore, your labor costs are lower per pound, right, being produced. Double down on that. That's your secret to the cost of production lower, right? So accurately identifying what you're better at than others, that's comparative advantage, and then like gung-ho using it to try to be, that's your edge, right? To get ahead, so to speak. The same thing holds in mine and yours world at other levels, but I'm trying to give you the kind of the on-farm applications of that. The comparative advantage notion is also underpinning my view that international trade is good. It raises both boats. Getting away from zero sum hinges on the fact that I think there's comparative advantage in both sides. So understanding the notion of comparative advantage and then leveraging it is something I strongly encourage us as society to get better at.
Yeah, yeah, a good one from a business class. So very much agree with that. Thank you so much, Glenn, for being a guest on our show. And we'll see you all next time on the Swinet Podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.